And we are back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. And once again, my favorite part of the show, and this is, it's one of my favorite guests. I'm biased. He's a friend of mine. But once again, able to welcome Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research to the show. Chase, how the heck are you?
Oh, doing great. How are you?
Hey, I'm hanging in there, pal. I'm hanging in there. Been doing exceptionally the last month or so. That run in gold has been pretty beneficial to us. But before we get into that, how's that little princess of yours doing?
She's doing great. Evelyn's growing like a weed, and she's happy and healthy, and so we're very blessed.
Is she talking about Uncle Zach yet, or not?
She's getting close.
Okay, yeah, I figured. I know that she listens to the show every week.
Oh, definitely.
She's already a hardcore econ and finance fan.
Yeah, soon she'll be a longtime listener and first-time caller.
Yes, absolutely. And we will take her calls any day of the week. I have a feeling, though, that she'll probably be a lot better at this job than both you and I are put together. So we might have to have her manage our money at some point.
There you go.
Anyway, hey, a lot to talk to you about here. Let's start. The last time we had you on, we spent an extensive period of time talking about what we thought, right? Everybody, it's V-shaped, it's U-shaped, all these, which drives me nuts, by the way. And I always hate it when we get into these discussions where they're just completely pointless and everybody wants to sound smart. And CNBC, is it a U-shape? Is it a V-shape? Whatever. You and I were in agreement that the minute you turn the economy off, yes, you'd see this jump up in activity and that it would sort of peter out. And you'd kind of have a flat line, and then it'd be kind of a really hard, long slog from there. When you look at the jobs data, even the GDP data, it really looks like that's kind of what's playing out, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, that initial rip up was going to happen just kind of based on, you know, just the math of how it works. You get that big of a drop, and you're naturally going to get a nice rebound, but it's really kind of flattening out. And you see that across almost all the macro data, including the, you know, some of the high frequency data, like the driving activity and things like that.
Right. Right. No, I've noticed all that, even in the airplane data. You see it all over the place. I think once again, and by the way, we were talking about it off air, so I forgot to mention it, but you actually coined it a square root recovery. And I was really, I told you this, I was quite jealous of that. You came up with that. I thought that was hilarious. But that, if you look at that macro data, even the jobs gains, the GDP data, all of it, it really is, you got that sharp downward move, that sharp bounce back, and it's already rolled over. It looks like it's going to make the top of that square root function. So tip of the cap, that was a clever, it's our square root recovery, we're going to call it here. What are you seeing in the data, Chase? What is interesting? What's catching your eye? What should we keep an eye on? Obviously, you had another one that I thought was great, is that for this, really this whole advance, this whole run up. And if you guys hear that in the background, that fire truck going by, this is one of the downsides of doing the show from the COVID bunker. We're not even going to edit that out. This is authentic Tacoma. Right. We're not in a sound studio. It's still the COVID bunker of Bulwark headquarters here. But when you start looking at all this data, what is the stuff that is really catching your eye? And then how do we get in here getting? Well, I digress. One of the things I want to talk about is you had another really good call where you said we've spent this whole run up Fed watching. Right. And now we need to Congress watch. And that is exactly what's happening. Right. You see the market taking a breath today. This is all based on stimulus. So let me ask you first. I want to get into what you see in the macro data. But let me ask you first, is the market right to be watching? This is a loaded question. Is the market right to be looking so singularly focused on what's going on here with the stimulus, and where are we at as far as that stimulus goes? Can they afford to cut it back? Where's the sweet spot? What are you making of this stimulus talk? Is it a lot of pomp and circumstance? Is this typical back and forth? Is it, you know, political horse trading? What's going on there? Is the market taking this too serious? Is the stimulus the only game in town? Kind of tell us how you're Congress watching right now.
Sure. And, you know, I didn't have to Congress watch. I think as bad as being a Fed watcher was, that this is worse. But I think fiscal policy is everything, and it will be probably for, you know, many years to come. The way Fed watching meant everything to markets in the past. And as you know, and you probably saw, I kind of made a chart for clients to show all of the initial Fed programs, all the different alphabet soup they were throwing out when they slashed rates, when they started QE, when they, you know, they said QE was unlimited. This is all happening in February and March. And the market just did not care about any of that. It just kept gapping down. We had limit down, I think, three times after they slashed rates and announced massive unlimited QE. And then Congress passed the CARES Act, and we've been going straight up ever since. And to me, like, that kind of captures, you know, where we're at with fiscal and monetary. Without the fiscal stimulus, the Fed, there's just not much they can do. It's kind of like they you know, they have a lighter and nothing to light on fire if they don't have the fiscal. So they're just going to be pushing on a string, and that's just kind of where we're at for the next probably decade, because, you know, they can't really cut rates anymore. Doing QE, they have to have the treasuries to buy, so they need that deficit spending. So to me, fiscal is everything. And as far as where we're at with it, you know, it probably is a lot of horse trading, and I'm sure they will eventually get something done. But, you know, we're less than 90 days out from the presidential election. So in my opinion, that gives Democrats kind of the leverage, you know, if they want to just run the clock out on this thing and let the economy get worse and worse and worse, that's probably going to hurt the incumbent, you know, more than it is the challenging party. And you know, the Senate is really up for grabs right now. So that makes it a really interesting dynamic. So to me, the Democrats have the leverage, but so far, you know, the Republicans have kind of played hardball. They just today, the Democrats offered to kind of split the difference between $1 trillion and $3 trillion, and the Republicans said no to that. So we're kind of, you know, we've been in these negotiations for weeks now, and really they've made no progress. So we had, you know, about 30 million people making $600 extra a week, and all that's gone. You know, we had the federal moratorium on evictions, that's gone. So, you know, we have millions of people losing a significant amount of income all of a sudden. And a lot of them are going to, you know, lose the place they live. And at the same time, you know, state and local governments are all hemorrhaging money. They're cutting back on staff. They're ending projects they were going to be using. So you just kind of have these self-reinforcing loops that are all kind of firing off at the same time. So if Congress doesn't pass, you know, an extension to these things, or if, you know, the talk lately is President Trump will, you know, use executive orders to get a lot of this stuff done, but that's clearly dubious legally, but he may do it anyways and, you know, worry about the legal part later, because it'll take time to get to through the judicial system. But, you know, the way I'm looking at this is everything. I'm honestly shocked that the market has kind of stayed as high as it has with this as a backdrop. I think the market has just decided, oh, like, you know, they'll eventually get around to it. They'll just go through some theatrics first, which is kind of the way, you know, they tend to operate. But I think so far this has been a little worse than a lot of people that just priced in. They'll get it done in a week or two, you know, kind of had in mind.
Well, I think it's a bit surprising to me, too, that the Republicans are digging in their heels on this. And I think this is a really important point that I want listeners to pick up on. Is that before you came on in the opening segment, or the opening salvo, as we'll call it here, I was reinforcing the need to stay politically biased or unbiased when we're looking at these things, and for all those arguing about a V-shaped recovery or this bounce back economically, what you need to know is that without that stimulus. Now, am I saying it's a good thing? No, and I don't think you are either. I mean, we're not making political statements one way or the other. I'm a big fan of free markets. I think that they've worked out remarkably well for our country and our economy. But I've got to play the field, right? I got to play the game that's in front of me, not the game I want to play. And I think that this is a perfect example of if everything was bouncing back so strong, you wouldn't need all this. If you pull it right now, you will get, it's like I said to a client, we're tap dancing on a trapdoor. I am shocked right now that the Republicans are digging in their heels. And I find it sort of ironic that they've decided that, you know, an $8 trillion deficit or a $9 trillion deficit, that's where we, that, right? That's the breaking point. We can't spend more than that for, what, especially considering the election coming up. What do you make of that on the political side? I know you're not a political analyst, but is this them trying to kind of dance the middle and shore up their base, you know, the part of the conservative party that's still worried about debt and deficits? Do you think they're trying to kind of dance that middle ground? Or what? I'm a little surprised that there's pushback and resistance. I'm a little surprised that the Democrats were as big a fans as rolling out another $3 trillion stimulus plan. Well, I'm not surprised. I just thought they'd do everything they could to make the, you know, make it tough sailing to make sure that Trump didn't get reelected. But what do you make of it on the political side?
Yeah, and I definitely agree with what you just said. You know, I mean, the Democrats just offered to throw $2 trillion into the economy, you know, 2.5 months before an election. Like, that would be a significant boost to the chances of the GOP holding the Senate and you know, maybe the presidency. Like, that's a significant offer to make. I mean, that's, even these days, $2 trillion is real money. So I am surprised with that, too. And I'm, you know, I think I would have expected some of the reddest, you know, states to find a way to let their representatives or their senators, you know, vote no on whatever came down so they can protect their fiscal credibility. But, you know, most of the rest, you know, would go along with it just because it was a political necessity. But it seems like there is genuine, like, pressure building within, especially the Senate GOP to resist anything that's large. You know, the Republicans couldn't even really agree themselves on this bill. They didn't really put forward a bill until after the unemployment enhancements had already expired. And so, and that was mostly because within, you know, within the party, they were struggling to reach consensus. And, you know, I've read 20, 30 senators weren't even okay with their proposal, which was $1 trillion. So there's going to be, it's going to be very difficult, whatever. So if the White House, you know, comes to an agreement with the Democrats, let's say it's $1.75 trillion and they all finally agree, that's going to be very difficult to get through the Senate. It would look like you're going to have to get, you know, a pretty decent handful of Democrats to vote for it. And you're going to have to get most, you know, Republicans on board. It's going to be difficult no matter what, you know, the compromise is here. And yeah, Mitch McConnell's already made it clear, like, hey, a lot of my senators are going to vote no to anything that we do here. So this is why, you know, to me, it's, everyone's just treating this as if they'll definitely get it done and it'll be huge and everything will be fine. And just looking at the situation, you know, they've been negotiating for weeks and they've gotten absolutely nowhere. So to me, this thing has the possibility of dragging on for a while.
I got to tell you, I'm against a complete shutdown of the economy the way they did it. I'm against this massive giveaway. I'm against $1.5 trillion deficits to begin with. I'm against a lot of this. So I don't want people reading one way or another. I believe in free markets, and free markets have a cost. Sometimes we go through tough times economically, but when the good times are good, I think it makes up for that. And I think the United States is the poster child of that. So I don't want anybody reading into this. But one of the things that I have grown really frustrated with is the economic illiteracy I see by virtually all politicians. And look, I'm not saying it like this is a new revelation, obviously, but, you know, the time to be upset was when we were running $1.3 trillion deficits and they kept approving the budget, right? Meaning that now they want to draw a line in the sand, right? And I get it. I mean, the spending is outrageous, but I'm going to get to a point, and I want you to tell me whether you agree with it or not, and you critique it. But the thing that I have been saying is that we need to wake up to the fact that we're terminal. And what I mean by that is that we have reached, in my opinion, we have crossed the event horizon of sound fiscal policy. And that the government spending and the government debt is so out of whack, and the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has grown so large as a percentage of the economy. I think by the end of the year, they're going to be at $10 trillion. Maybe I'm off by one or two either way, but you know, I think it's only a matter of time till we're looking at them at least being at, you know, the balance sheet being 50% the entire size of the economy. And for that matter, I think they're going to get to 100 at some point the not too distant future. I don't see any way around it. But I'm sitting there going, hey, we're terminal, right? The decisions that you should be making when digging in your heels, that ship has sailed, right? Now, if they don't do this, if they don't pass this stimulus bill, just sit back and admit to where you're at. You've been intervening and printing and deficit spending for so long, you can't pull back now. If you do, the whole bloody thing comes apart and you're going to have an economic collapse on your hands. And like, that's just the reality of it. Am I in favor of it? No, but it's where we're at. Do you agree?
Yeah, I absolutely. I think all the off ramps to like, you know, the situation we're in, we passed up all those off ramps a long time ago.
Yep.
We didn't stop and get gas this whole time. And now we're in the mountains and a blizzard's hitting. It's now's the wrong time to, you know, go looking for a place to stop it. In my opinion, the ship sailed a long time ago, really on being able to like arrest this whole situation and be fiscally responsible, to be monetarily responsible. That's all, in my opinion, that's all long gone. At this point, what it's come down to, and the way this is going to shake out, is they're going to have to inflate away this debt load to get it to go away. You know, we live in a democracy where people get to vote on these things, and people aren't going to vote for austerity. People are not going to vote for a default. They're not going to let that happen. But what people will vote for is having their student loans forgiven and having, you know, all these different forms of bailouts and free money. What we're seeing right now is kind of the tip of the iceberg. And yeah, this is a genuine emergency, and it makes more sense to do things like this during a time like this. But I think a lot of what we're seeing right now, that are emergency measures, are going to become kind of the norm moving forward. And, you know, until we have significant inflation that makes debt to GDP levels come down, they're just going to have to keep doing this stuff. It's unfortunate, and you know, it's going to come along with a lot less free markets than you know, we've had in the last 30 years. These things kind of work in cycles, and unfortunately, we're going to get a lot less of that moving forward. Because, you know, like you, I'm a market guy, I'm a capitalist guy, but we've kind of ruined that for ourselves by letting it run too far and letting the cronyism get too far. So it's unfortunately going to have to unravel in an uncomfortable way over the next generation, really.
Yeah, no, and I find myself getting upset about it periodically, just because, you know, again, the fact that they're digging their heels in now, I just sit there and I just feel like it's just a joke. Just because it's run so far. We were looking at something, Chase. Remember back in the day, late 90s, where we had a balanced budget. Last time we had a balanced budget. And pre-COVID, when we were sitting there in January, before anybody knew that any of this stuff was going to happen, we were looking at a $1.35 trillion budget deficit this year alone, right? So before pre-COVID, we're looking at 6.5% budget deficit. And my point is, Let's sit back as clear-headed people, and I think I'm more convinced now that there are less of us in America today than at any other time. It seems like that's kind of turned into the most rare bird, right? Finding somebody that's rational and clear-headed. But you were at a point even pre-COVID, and again, this is not a knock on the current administration. A lot of people will try to spin it that way, but we were running these kind of deficits before he came into office too. So, you know, again, this wheel has been spinning for a long time. But you looked at, you know, we were sitting there going, okay, if you balance the budget, right? If you just balance the budget this year, said we're going to spend as much as we bring in, you would have been looking at a 6.5% hit to GDP, right? Just via the deficit alone. So, you know, you look at the financial crisis was what, 3.8%, 3.9% hit to GDP? Just balancing the budget would be an economic hit you know, 40, 50, 60% larger than the financial crisis. I don't think anybody's being realistic about where we're at. And these people going, no, we can get this train back on the tracks. No, you can't. Like you said, inflating it away now, it's really the only game in town. And I'm not being pessimistic, but when you've got $30 trillion, when you're 150% debt to GDP, you don't grow your way out of that. Nobody's done the math. We sat down and did the math at one point. I'm sure you and I have talked about it. But this is when we were like at 110%, 115% debt to GDP. It required something like it required a balanced budget and then like 5 or 6% GDP growth over the next 20 years or something like that. Now you're at 150. You don't grow your way out of that. Your only choice is to inflate it away, is it not?
Yeah, and the only way you're going to grow out of it is, you may get some high growth, but it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be real growth. It's going to be nominal growth, which is what we will get. And it all depends on how you know, Congress spends this money moving forward. If they do really non-productive spending, then we'll have, you know, high inflation and low growth. If they find a way to do some actual productive spending, they find areas that, you know, could really use the money, and they put the money in the right places, then we can actually get some high growth, but it'll still be relatively low real growth, you know, it'll just be nominal. So inflation adjusted, it's not gonna be that great. So I think we'll reach a point where, you know, we're growing it at 10%, but, you know, inflation is at 8%. So you're kind of growing more like 2%. I think we're gonna get some of that. It all comes down to how productive, you know, the money is as we move forward into, you know, more like $3 to $5 trillion deficits, because that's where we're headed, and that will be not just emergency time, but just all the time deficits. And it just comes down to, you know, how productive is it? There's been times in the past where governments have spent a lot of money, and, you know, you had the interstate highway system, and you're inventing things like the internet and radar and satellites and. Yeah, like when you do stuff like that, you know, you can add a lot of productivity to the economy and add a lot of wealth to the economy. But if you're just throwing it all down, you know,
just giveaways.
If it's just giveaways, or, you know, a lot of corruption, you know, or maybe you're giving Kodak a bunch of money to start making pills or whatever. Like, you're probably not going to get a lot of productivity growth out of things like that.
Well, and so, this is one of the things we were talking about in the intro, which is. You know, I know you and I have similar views on this, but believing really, truly in a diversified portfolio, and this is why I was telling people, and we've been hammering on this since, I know you and I have been on the same page about this too, but we've been hammering on it since this downturn started, knowing what the government response was going to be and what it had to be, and just saying, okay, if you've doubted gold or silver or a precious metal allocation in your portfolio, now is the time to set that doubt aside, right? To move on. And then we have seen this rip your face off rally. And again, in the previous segment, I was just telling people, we did a segment called The Anatomy of a Failure, where I was doing the postmortem on my Tailored Brands investment. So, you know, the listeners know that I don't posture myself as a guy that always gets it right. But that gold trade and that silver trade was so obvious. And there is still so much consternation about it. I was laughing when I was looking through my Twitter feed earlier today. Mark Dow, who fancies himself a very intelligent man, and I'm sure he is. I'm just always amused by people that really buy their own hype. And smart guy, again, not meant as a slam against him. It just, you know, you can tell that he believes it. He's sitting there, you know, talking down gold, and I'm just laughing going, are you kidding me, man? It's the best performing asset class this year. If you can feel free to disagree, but I look at it right now and I go, look, it's not going to be a smooth ride. It's not to infinity and beyond. But if you've doubted the need for precious metals or some aspect of your portfolio that's going to defend you from the degradation and the devaluation of the dollar, now is the time to set that doubt aside. Would you agree?
Oh, 100%. If you had to just sit down with a notepad and a pen and you know, you had an assignment to create a situation that would be the best, the best possible situation for precious metals to go up, you would basically, the plan you would write up is exactly what's happening. You know, what's best for gold is negative real interest rates, which is, you know, what we have now, by about -1% already. And that's going to get much deeper in the negative as inflation eventually, you know, really starts to appear, and as interest rates, you know, are kept down. That's one thing the Fed can do that will be effective, is that, you know, they're going to pin interest rates really low and they're going to keep them there. And when they do that, while inflation, you know, starts to run hot, then there's no point in buying bonds for protection. You can buy a little bit of stocks for protection, but historically, precious metals outperform equities whenever you get some pretty high inflation. So you just have to be in precious metals and things like oil if we're going to get deeply negative rates. It's like this was a script written for gold to go higher, and honestly much higher, especially over the next decade. Like you say, like, it's not going to be a smooth ride. It's probably a little overbought right now, and we probably need a little bit of a washout to get a lot of the new people, the Robin Hood people that don't really understand the trade, that just bought because it was going up. Sure, like, we could probably use a washout now, but, you know, if you just zoom out and look over the next 5-10 years, it's really, in my opinion, it should be the anchor of a lot of people's portfolio.
You know, I would agree. Now, we did trim back our gold positions by about a third, I think, at the beginning of the week. Just because, if you know, we're trading around it, keeping our core position. Sure. That's another thing I think that people need to learn what that's like, right? You get into a phase like this, and this doesn't apply to gold, but, you know, when you have something that you have a lot of conviction in, you maintain that core position. And if, you know, maybe you just ride it all the way out, but I like to maintain that core position and trade around it. And that's kind of what we did. We took some profits hoping for a better entry point. It looks like we might be getting it here. And then again, you know, it always, I do have something that I have learned over time through study of history. And I think it's important to trade around the position, maintain your core, because we are at a point in history right now where, especially over the weekends, right? Beware the Ides of March, beware the weekend. Right, because we've had some historical announcements in the past come out over the weekends, and like you said, you could not come up with or create a better environment for precious metals and gold in particular. And I think it's really important that you maintain that core position and ride it out, trade around it, but do not let yourself not have some exposure over any weekend. Because you and I both, you know, 71, right? Camp David, Nixon was it on a Sunday. He announced that the depegging of the dollar from gold, elimination of the gold standard. These things tend to happen over the weekends. And I remember when we first started this plunge in March, or in February rather, I remember sitting there going, okay, now's the time to lock in our gold positions and ride them out no matter what. I will not let gold not be in the portfolio over a weekend from here on out. And in my opinion, I think that's the best way to proceed. Where else do you think? Do you think silver is a part of that? What else do you want? You mentioned gold. Where are we at with nat gas? I know you've been a big proponent of nat gas. Where are we at with nat gas? What is your outlook there? And also, does nat gas fit into that category as well? Kind of a weird deal.
So it does, but less so. Whenever I look at like more basic commodities, but energy, agriculture, to me, they are an inflation hedge, and they should be involved in any, you know. So I want to own a lot of real assets for the next 10, 20 years. So I have a portfolio that's literally just real assets that I run, and I don't really, you know, sell much of that. I trade around those other, you know, in a futures account and stuff, but I have an equity account that's just a lot of real assets, and I'm just long only, and I'm just piling in. And in that account, it's all real assets. So I want to have things like, you know, agriculture, and I want to have natural gas, oil, things like that, timber. But, you know, when it comes to a more macro level, I think oil is like a legitimate strategic asset for inflation. Whereas I think things like, you know, maybe corn or natural gas, like, they should be part of a plan for inflation, but less so. I think you kind of have to back away and look at those kind of assets more on a supply and demand perspective, the capital cycle perspective. And that's what really brought me to natural gas, and that's why I love it. And I do expect to stay Bullish on natural gas for probably a pretty long time. You know, I've been involved in this trade really since early this year, so I expect it to stay that way. I just love the supply and demand picture. The price action has been great lately. You know, we kind of had ripped higher after the Saudis started the oil price war, because we started pricing in like, okay, like a lot of the shale production is going to go away, and a lot of natural gas production is tied to shale production. So that, you know, kind of put us on a little short-term rocket ship. And then, but about that time, you know, with the virus slowing down demand globally, a lot of liquefied natural gas exports started getting hit, just because demand was dropping overseas, especially in Asia. So I track natural gas prices like in Asia and Europe, and those just got hammered. So that kind of set us back for a few months, but now that's clearing out, and these LNG exports are starting to go up a lot more. Production is kind of steadily falling for natural gas, because that associated production with shale is just steadily falling away, and it's going to keep happening. I think the Marcellus Shale has probably peaked, and which is kind of the biggest shale field up in Appalachia. And because that's probably peaked, the decline rates is just kind of just naturally falls. We're just going to keep seeing higher and higher prices, because demand's, you know, not going anywhere, especially in times like, you know, we've had recently, where it's been really hot throughout the country. That drives a lot of demand for natural gas, and then you just kind of have steadily ticking down production. So supply and demand wise, it looks great. And sure, like the macro tailwind of, you know, kind of starting to enter an inflationary period here in the next few years, like it's just kind of a nice tailwind to have on top of the supply and demand picture.
Yeah. What, going out a little more globally, and then as it relates to China, what are you seeing there? Is their economy responding quicker? I mean, of course, we can't really trust the data, because China will try to tell you it's never been better. What are you seeing there? What are some of the dynamics playing out there? Is there anything interesting? Or if it's not China, are there other parts of the world that you're focused on more? Because I think one of the things that gets overlooked, and you and I talked about at the very beginning of this, is that naturally the focus is going to be myopically on the US. And I get that. We're the largest economy in the world. At the same time, this is a global economic issue. And I don't hear nearly enough talk about the rest of the world, right? What is it? You know, I want to say, what is it? 55% of our GDP now comes from overseas, or something like that. Or excuse me, maybe it's 45% or 43. Anyway, it's nearly half. Well, what are you seeing around the rest of the world? What are you focused on the global macro picture?
Yeah, so as always, China is just incredibly important for the macro picture. China's really driven a global reflation trade here in the last few months. They hit the stimulus button really, really hard. And you know, they're just such a big economy that when they do that, it has been in big impacts everywhere. So they've, you know, they now they're fighting prop their pro property bubbles again. They're trying to deal with that. They, you know, had kind of a speculative blow off in stocks there for really only for a couple of weeks. Chinese stocks just went straight up. So because they're pumping so much, you know, stimulus in, they're having to put out some speculative fires. But it just goes to show, you know, how much they are stimulating. And you can see it in like the price of copper, iron ore, that it have really, you know, been great. The Australian dollar's been on a tear. And interestingly enough, if you know, throw up a chart of the S&P 500 and the Australian dollar, it's basically the same chart. So that also tells you know, this Chinese stimulus is helping world markets, including in the US. And interestingly, copper has just rolled over today. It's off about 4%. It's breaking some uptrends that have been in place really since the bottom in March. So, you know, you would expect, and we're having weakness in the Australian dollar today by about 1%. So if that breaks its trend and copper breaks its trend, you know, then you start to, that coupled with what's going on with the fiscal situation in the US, you start building in a lot of fragility in the whole recovery in asset prices over the last few months. And China is talking about, you know, hey, we're going to keep a lot of fiscal stimulus, but we're going to start rolling back some of this monetary stimulus. That's what they've explicitly talked about here really in the last couple of weeks. So if they hold firm on that and actually kind of withdraw some stimulus, then we should see a lot of this reflation trade, the metals, energy, a lot of these, stocks globally, it should start to roll over. And if the dollar has bottomed, which it kind of looks like it's trying to right now, if the dollar has bottomed and it starts to march higher, then those reflation trades are really going to take a hit coming up. So yeah, China's huge, and I've been watching Europe a lot lately because obviously they had, a big fiscal package that passed that got a lot of fanfare, pushed the euro up. They've frankly done a lot better job with the COVID situation than the US, at least from the numbers standpoint, which also helped the euro go up. But now all of a sudden, we're starting to see numbers looking like they're peaking for COVID in the US, and you're starting to see a new wave kind of starting up in Europe. So that could completely unwind all the strength the euro's had lately. And again, that will not be good for those reflation trades and base metals and things of that nature.
One of the things I think is funny is you had, I call them the China cheerleaders. All these people talking about China. China's pivoting now. They're going to a service-based economy. I think it's hilarious that the way they still stimulate the exact same way. That pivot to a service-based economy, it doesn't appear to be going well. Am I wrong reading it that way? Because it looks to me like no matter what they say, when it comes time, when some any time economic hardship hits, they stimulate the same way. They keep going back to the well because they cannot get off of this. Even though the property bubbles and all this kind of stuff, they can't get away from it. Am I reading that correctly, or do you think I'm off?
No, that's how I see it. And don't get me wrong, they've made a lot of strides, opening up that service-based economy, and their consumers have been spending a lot of money, and that has become a bigger proportion of their economy for sure. But like you say, whenever it gets weird and they have to do something, they break glass. You have to break the glass in an emergency. They just start pumping the same old stuff, which short term is great. You get a nice little sugar high out of that, and it keeps people employed, which is a big part of what they need. But at the same time, it's not particularly productive, and it has a lot of long run consequences for sure. And they had done a really good job in the last, 2, 3 years. It's something that China bears didn't really acknowledge, but they dramatically cut back on, their shadow banking system, and they were really cleaning up a lot of debt within the economy. But as soon as, this struck, they kind of, I mean, they started pumping money right back on into like all the old school stimulus measures. They let non-performing loans explode again. They let shadow banks, become kind of the transmission mechanism to get money into the real economy again, because the real banks just aren't really up to the task. So, and you're seeing a lot of this money flowing into, not the mom pop small businesses that they really have tried to stimulate and get going, because they know that, that's a good place for real economic growth going forward for them. So all this money has really found its way into the big state-owned companies. And it just looks kind of like mid-2000s stimulus, where a lot of it's going to be wasted.
Yeah, well, the other thing too, and I've read all the stories about them cleaning up a lot of debt. I don't really know how that is. How is it that they're cleaning up a lot of debt when they still have this unbelievable property? Like I look at the price controls on property and all this kind of stuff. Can you clean up the debt there if you're not addressing the property scenario? I mean, I look at that and I am puzzled as to how they're going to get past that, right? Like how, I mean,
I
from
don't think
my
anyone
understanding,
knows.
well, right, because from my understanding, you've got people sitting on these gains in real estate. At the same time, they can't sell it because nobody will pay what it's supposedly worth, right? How do you attack that? I mean, they can't just keep, and I at this point, right, they're stimulating the old way, like you said, so building some more condominiums that nobody's going to live in. How do they get past this?
The only way they'll be able to do it really is to, they're going to have to, really open up, the kind of like the financial account of the company. They're gonna have to have actual positive real interest rates for savers. We see all this enormous investment they do in infrastructure and everything over the last, 20, 30 years, and the whole world marvels at it. But the reality is they've kind of done the same thing as the Soviet Union and Japan did long ago. It's a it's a common model that gets used, and it works really, really good for a while. All you really do is you offer a deeply negative savings rate to regular people, and all the money that you just put all that money in a bag and you hand it to people to go build stuff. It's essentially the way it works.
Right.
So, but it, you know, if you do that, let's say inflation was 5% and I was offering you 0.1% to save money, you know, and you're a regular person, you're smart enough to realize like, that's not a good bet for me. So, but hey, like apartment buildings, those go up 10% a year. So that I'll save my money in those. And that's what, you know, Chinese people do. They save their money by buying an apartment that no one even lives in. And interestingly enough, you know, a lot of those apartments that these people buy, it's a weird thing to Americans because, you know, when you buy an apartment in America, like it's an apartment, but over there it's just empty concrete walls. Like they don't build anything into them. So you don't have like a place you could live, you know, with like a bathroom and everything. It's just like an empty shell. It's like an empty shell. That's basically a savings account because a real savings account is not going to pay you anything. And you know, if you offered a real return on savings, you know, maybe people could stop doing that, but you know, for the macro economy, how you let air out of that bubble without really hurting the economy, like that's going to be incredibly challenging. You know, Japan's insane, you know, property bubble, you know, they're kind of in a lot of ways still feeling the effect of that. So,
oh yeah.
And that was, you know, 30 years ago. So yeah, I don't know how they'll get around this. I don't think they do either.
They've made an absolute mess. Well, not just by they, I mean everybody in power, not just China, everywhere. And this goes back to our conversation about talking about how, you know, I just do not see us getting away at any time in the foreseeable future without deeper and deeper government intervention into markets. You've just built up this scenario where the debt loads are so high, the prices are so detached from reality that just taking their foot off the gas, it would be the economic crisis, right? Do you agree with that? Just allowing it, just pulling your foot off the gas, not cutting, just pulling it off the gas, that would be reason enough for a lot of this stuff to blow up.
Absolutely. I mean, the last stimulus bill was $3.5 trillion. That should be years worth of spending, but you know, we're going to get another $2-3 trillion stimulus bill, or we're going to have a lot of problems. So it just goes to show you, you know, the numbers have to keep getting bigger and bigger. The pace has to stay there. It's just like a treadmill that you're running on, and it just keeps coming at you faster and faster. Someone's just got their finger on the button and they turn it from 7 to 8 to 9, and you know, you're just dying to keep going.
You know what frustrates me the most about this, Chase? We talked about this a little bit earlier, but just to revisit it. The thing that frustrates me about this is guys like you and I have been talking about this scenario literally for 12 years when the bailout packages got announced in 2008, just sitting there going, okay, if this is the game you're going to play, just know that you don't ever get to back away from the table, because that influx of printed money and that artificial, you know, capital, you know, the deficit spending, all, you cannot do that and then pull it out, right? It becomes part of the ecosystem. And you know, guys like you and I have been sitting there talking about for, again, longer than a decade, just going, you're never going to be able to get out of this. And I just think back to Janet Yellen saying that we're going to normalize the balance sheet and it's going to be as exciting as watching paint dry. And it makes me want to pound my head against a wall. And then we run into this scenario, which is inevitable, right? I mean, COVID wasn't inevitable, but something bad is going to happen. And we know what the answer is going to be, right? Maybe it's war, maybe it's an epidemic, maybe it's, you know, a pandemic, maybe it's, you know, fill in the blank, but bad things happen. And when that occurs, you're going to have to double down, and then you're going to be even deeper into the hole. It's the lack of foresight that is so maddening to me, and the unwillingness for politicians to allow economies to take their medicine and take their pain, because pain up front equals better times in the future, and nobody's willing to do that. And I referenced this earlier, and I said we're terminal, and what I meant by that is that I don't think that there are any off-ramps. You said you use that term too. I don't think that there are any off-ramps between now and just total currency debasement, total currency devaluation, maybe a restructuring of the international currency system. Now, obviously, you agreed with me earlier about the government not being able to take off the gas, but is that where this goes? Are we just headed to a restructuring of the currency system or maybe a debt jubilee? I mean, I just don't see where we go from here.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned the debt jubilee because, in my opinion, that's exactly what we are already starting right now. This is this we're in the debt jubilee. You know, people keep looking for when to happen. It's already here. In fact, so you've had Grant Williams and Bill Fleckenstein on the show, and they have a little show they're doing themselves called The Endgame, and it's a great show because this is what they talk about is like how this all ends up playing out. You know what the endgame looks like. They've done some great interviews on that. And something Bill always talks about, and he's always been very curious about this. I went to an event in Oregon where he spoke, and he talked about this. He's been talking about for years is, you know, Japan now owns, you know, a lion's share of the government's debt on the Bank of Japan's balance sheet. And like, he's very fascinated by like what happens with that. Like, is that even, you know, if they just canceled that or they turned it into like a, you know, perpetual that just kind of always sat on the balance sheet. Like, what would that do to the yen? What would that do to Japanese stocks? What would that do to the economy? Like, how would people view that? And I've always viewed this as like, you don't have to retire the debt. You don't have to do anything with it. It once it hits the government or the central bank's balance sheet, it is, to me, it's dead. Like, it's not even, this is controversial, but to me, it's not even debt anymore. So if I look at the debt to GDP ratio, all the debt that has been put on the central bank's balance sheet isn't even debt anymore. It's just like an inert thing that it's kind of doesn't exist anymore. It's now a perpetual and non-interest bearing transfer from the government to a central bank balance sheet where it's just never going to move. It's just gone. And if that's not a debt jubilee, to me, nothing is. So, and obviously you can't get away with that forever. Eventually you reach a point where you're going to cause a lot of inflation and that's where we're going to go. But so to me, you're going to end up with trillions and trillions of dollars spent by the government, and it's going to be printed up by you know, the central banks, and then it's going to sit on their balance sheet. It's just going to sit there, and it's never going away. So whenever, you know, Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke and all these people talked about, you know, rolling off the balance sheet, I don't think they really believed they would be able to do that. I think they knew all along what the end game looked like. Ben Bernanke's famous helicopter money speech, that was in 2002. So, and if you go back and read that speech, I mean, he completely nailed everything that would happen and what they would have to do, you know, to get out of all this. And that's 18 years ago he gave that speech. So he saw this clearly. He knew the way this was going to go down. I think, you know, they pay lip service about, oh, you know, we'll let some paint dry and watch trillions of dollars come off the balance sheet. That was completely unrealistic. So when it comes to the end game, I think, you know, we're already in it, and this is a debt jubilee. If Congress says, hey, here's all the student loan debt paid off with a wave of the government wand, and then they take all that and they put it on the Fed's balance sheet, this is gone forever.
Well, no,
that is a debt jubilee.
And here's the problem. And I know there are a lot of people listening to this show going, we can't pay off student loans. And I get it. I'm with you. I understand the ethos behind you saying that. At the same time, You're at a place where the spending has been so profligate, it's really hard to make a responsible argument and have a responsible and coherent debate about how that is worse than spending $1.5 trillion on an extra $600 a month for people. I mean, paying off student loans would be far more stimulative, especially in the long run, wouldn't it?
100%. So this is why I think we could have an inflationary boom, one where growth really picks up and you know, makes the economy look great. If, you know, millennials are, and I am one, are in pretty bad shape financially, you know, as a group. And a lot of it's because, you know, we've gone through a couple crises. A lot of us have a lot of student loan debt. We can't buy a house because they're really expensive, all these things. Well, you know, now mortgages are like 2%. If they go to 1%, if you just take all of that, you know, debt off their balance sheets for student loans, like all of a sudden millennials, you know, and they're coming of age, like they're really exploding and starting to form families. And you just take this giant, you know, albatross that's on their neck and take it off. It frees them to really spend. And it's an enormous generation. So if you take this huge generation and you give it a hot economy where, you know, unemployment's 2% and you can buy a house for 1% to finance it, take all their debt away. Like, yeah, you can get some nice economic growth in a situation like that. And I think that's exactly what will happen.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, just so people know, I don't think either of you are at you. No. We're not advocating it. This is just an acknowledgement of where we're at and what they're going to do, because here's the one thing I know they're not going to do. They're not going to get religion. They're not going to start advocating for the balancing of the budget. They're not going to advocate. Think about the president. You haven't heard a word said about, you said this earlier, but you haven't heard a word said about the debt. You're going to be sitting at $30 trillion in debt by the end of this year, 150% debt to GDP. I mean, if we're not talking about it now, when are we going to? And the reason why is nobody's going to be able to get elected. Right. Talking about that. No one's going to get elected by talking about balancing the budget. They're going to get elected by promising more stuff, period. And, you know, I don't see any alternative. And the other dangerous thing, and again, I think this is important to bring up because people are, again, I know I got a lot of listeners out there like, you're advocating for, no, I'm not advocating for paying off student loans. What I'm saying is when you get to a point where deficit spending and Federal Reserve money printing adds up to $13.5 trillion in a single year, at that point, what is another $1.5 trillion, right? I mean, does it even make a difference?
Yeah, exactly. That's about a third of, you know, what they've done this year in stimulative spending. So, and I think that would be a more productive way, because that would free up real people to spend real money, you know, and that would be... to me, that's better for the economy than bailing out, you know, airlines that could just go through the bankruptcy process, or you throwing money at Kodak to make pharmaceuticals, or you know, there's a lot worse ways to spend money. And that's, I'm not saying it's a good idea. Like, to me, there's like obviously a lot of moral hazard in that, and it's not fair for a lot of people that have paid off their student loans. Like, I hate the policy, but you know, viewed against other ways to stimulate the economy, I think it's a more productive way. You would get more out of it.
Yeah, no,
we're going into an era where so much money is going to get printed and put in the economy. You have to look for ways to do it in a way where, you know, you get a lot of bang for your buck. And, you know, whether you like it or not, that is one that you will get a lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah, no, I know. I literally just paid off my last student loan yesterday. And, you know, I'm glad that it's done. At the same time, I'm sitting there going, just when we finish paying it off, yeah. I know what's coming, right? I know about a bunch of people are going to be able to, and we had a good pile. I mean, my wife and I had to put ourselves through school. We worked while we were at school to help limit the amount we were putting on student loans, but she's got a master's degree. I'm finance degree. I mean, it wasn't cheap. We had to pay it off. And I again, this is just us acknowledging where we're at. And the other thing that infuriates me about this is one of the reasons, and I'm not trying to just beat up on the Fed, but let's be honest. One of the reasons that the millennials are one of the slowest, if not the slowest, to make financial progress as a generation, that's a direct result in what the Fed has done. Meaning that I think a lot of people look past the only upside, right? All they talk about is we got to generate inflation. The only upside to an economic downturn is lower prices, right? And that allows new players to come in and purchase assets on the cheap. The millennials have never gotten a bite at that apple, right? Thank you to the Fed, because everything has just been jacking up prices still. Right. Like a situation like now where millennials should be getting a chance to buy a house and a stock market at cheaper prices. And I realize that means the rest of us that own those assets have to take a hit. But don't you see a direct correlation there between what the Fed has done and the inability for millennials to launch and to finally fly the nest?
Absolutely. I mean, there's just no doubt about it.
Right. And they will never address that, because you did hear Jay Powell say that the Fed has nothing to do with wealth inequality, right?
Yeah, that, which is obviously absurd, and he knows it's absurd. I'm shocked he even said it. To me, that's an area where you could just kind of keep it real, and no one would get too mad, because we all know it's true.
But, yeah, well, and even he does to a degree, and this is why I wanted to reference something you said earlier about when they said it'd be easy to watch, it'd be like watching paint dry, and you said that you didn't think Yellen even believed it at the time. Here's the issue that I have. I've had this thought and played this mental exercise several times. But if they didn't mean that, right, and if Bernanke, and if they saw it coming, then if you start thinking about it, because, see, I kind of think they do mean it, and I could be wrong. But I kind of think they do believe it. And the reason why is it melds perfectly with all the other nonsense they say. Like, look at all the economic forecasts of where Bernanke, when he was still in office, was telling us we'd be by the year 2014, 2015. I mean, talk about not being able to hit water if you fell out of a boat. I mean, these people were so off. They were off about when we'd get the recovery of the jobs, right? They'd be off. They were off, you know, literally everything. It couldn't be worse. And then I start thinking to myself, okay, if they knew they were lying about that and they knew that they were just blowing smoke, then that kind of insinuates that they lie about everything. Do you believe it's all just lipstick on the pig? They don't believe any of it?
I think they believe a lot of it, and I think they're wrong about a lot, and they're wrong, like, legitimately. And a lot of that's tied to the fact that they try to turn, you know, real life and the economy into mathematical models. And I think a lot of them really, like, I mean, that is the language of the economics profession. And it's, you know, to me, it's a false god. It's no way to look at the economy through mathematic models. It's just, to me, it's absurd. It's a complex adaptive system. There's no point in even trying to model it in the way that they do anyway. And I think a lot of them do have their head kind of stuck in that. And so they see the world through that prism. And I think that does lend them to sometimes believe things that are, you know, obviously kind of absurd if you're in the real world and you look at it. But at the same time, you know, if I look at Bernanke's 2002 speech about helicopter money, and if you read the whole thing, it kind of becomes clear, you know, he's already starting to get ready for what would have to come. And all you got to do is go back and, you know, look at all the long-term debt cycles and how they ended throughout history and, you know, and to realize, like, this kind of just happens every time. Like, what we're seeing now has happened before, and it's happened many times. It's just part of human nature. We, like, you know, you talked about earlier, like, no one's willing to take short-term pain. And because as humans, we aren't good at valuing time, and we aren't good at taking short-term pain for long-term gain. Because that is so true, you're just kind of destined to build these long cycles where, you know, every 5 to 10 years you kick the can down the road until you get to the end of the road. And, you know, we're at the end of the road where interest rates are zero and there, you can't kick that can anymore. So the only can that can be kicked now is the inflation can and the fiscal spending can. To me, it's just a natural cycle, just as natural as, you know, cycles of the sun or tides or anything like that. So yeah, sure. The Fed, I think some of them do believe, you know, their own nonsense at times, but I think a lot of them probably know kind of where we're at in the long-term cycle, what they're going to have to do to get us through it. What was done, you know, during World War II to get us out of enormous debt to GDP ratios in the past. And something else, this is kind of off topic, but it's interesting to me is, you know, for really the last, I don't know, you could say 1,000 years, 2,000 years, whatever, we've had, you know, a world that has had a growing population, a growing working population, and a lot of, you know, innovation throughout this whole time. And now all of a sudden, like, really for the first time, you know, in any of our lives, like, we're starting to see populations really slow their growth, and in some places, you know, start to fall, especially working age populations. So it's easy to say that everything we think we know about the way economies work was very tied to having a growing population. So the way we measure everything, the way we model everything, it's all been built on, hey, the population's growing. Well, now it's not. So that kind of throws a wrench into this thing. For most of history, we had a gold standard. We're so used to modeling everything off the way the world worked in a gold standard. Now it's all just fiat money. So there are so many things we think we know. We think we know how things work, and we don't. And that's one area where I think, you know, a lot more humility would be would be nice for the Fed to understand, you know, that they don't have, you know, wrenches to fine tune every part of the economy, that this is a complex adaptive system, that there are, you know, there are feedback loops they can't even see, that, you know, there are butterfly effects that they set off and they would never even recognize that they were doing it. It's a very difficult puzzle, and the fact that they seem convinced they can solve it, you know, it, to me, is troublesome.
Yeah, well, and to me, that's what scares me so much, especially considering their age, that people that age think that they can control something like the largest economy in the history of mankind. I mean, that just the hubris and the pride required to even stand up there with a straight face and try to give answers. And then the other thing is that they are in so deep, and they have taken us, and it's not just us, or it's not just them. I know I tend to focus on them a lot, but along with legislators and then, you know, people voting these people in, we all have a part to play, but they have taken us so far off the path. One of the things that scares me is that if they did have that moment of realization, if they did realize that what they have dedicated their lives to is completely worthless and completely wrong, they're in so deep, they're not going to admit it. You know, it's like the guy that finds out that he's been worshiping a false god up into the day he dies, right? He's spent so much time at this point, right? He's not going back. And
pot committed.
Yeah, you're pot committed. And that's the thing that scares me. And you're never going to hear them take any blame for it and say we need to alter course, even though everything they said would happen as a result of the bailouts in 08, 09, none of it came to pass. Right? None of it. They exacerbated every single problem that they set out to eliminate. And it's more than frustrating. And here we are again, right? Dealing with another situation, which is just, you know, kind of like the financial crisis on steroids. And then the other thing that irritates me, and we got to close up here, but one of the things that irritates me about it is everybody goes, well, you couldn't see this coming. You know, who could have known? And I'm sitting there once again, beating my head against the wall going, you're missing the point. There's always something that happens that nobody planned for, right? Again, like you said, it's a dynamic, adaptive system. There's always going to be surprises. So don't look at, you know, it's like sitting there going, you know, the barn was stuffed with hay and we saw a kid out there pouring gasoline on the roof, but we never thought lightning would hit it. You know, we never thought there'd be a spark of any kind to set it off. And you go, well, look, common sense tells us that if we create hazard, if we create the potential for a disaster, it's only a matter of time until a catalyst shows up. And you know, or to put it in the terms of Taleb, right? It's the opposite of anti-fragile. We're making everything so fragile, right? Building our house on a sand where the first wind that comes along or the first storm that pops up, we're smoked. And you know, that's what this is why you don't carry record amounts of corporate debt. You know, I look back to the airlines, right? And we need a $25 billion bailout. Everybody forgets that they'd spent $45 billion in stock buybacks over the previous 9 years, right? Do they need the bailout or do they need to manage their balance sheet more responsibly? And it just, it's infuriating. Anyway, you're on here. Give us your final thoughts, things that we should be looking out for and things that you're going to be watching over the next coming weeks.
Sure. I think what's really important now, that reflation trade I was talking about, you know, is copper, Australian dollar, metals. Are these things going to keep kind of rolling over? Like, are we going to see a lot of air come out of the reflation trade, including, you know, U.S. stock market? Is that going to keep rolling over? Is that just a blip? Is the dollar, you know, really going to break down, or is this bounce, you know, going to turn into something? Those are like kind of the biggest things on my radar right now. And I'm, you know, as we talked about earlier, I'm still excited about, some, you know, small corners of the market that I like natural gas and uranium, obviously precious metals. Although I trimmed up my positions a good bit there. It's just got a little frothy for me, but, watching all that. And I really think, you know, sadly, we got to pay attention to what's happening with fiscal stimulus in Congress. And I think if something doesn't happen there soon, I think you could see another kind of volatility spiking event in the next week or two.
No, I agree. And look, and this has been happening, like I said, for the last 12 years, right? If they don't get it done, the market will make sure that they get it done. Because the one thing that seems to get everybody's attention is a falling stock market. And that will be what happens. And, you know, then I'm sure that you'll get the subsequent rally when they finally capitulate. Because if you want to know how to make legislators squeal and the Federal Reserve to act, just hit the sell button, right? I mean,
no doubt.
It's been pretty predictable. So anyway, all right, guys. Well, we got to get rolling. Ran out of time here. Chase, thank you so much for joining us. And if people want to follow you, they can follow you at Pinecone Macro on Twitter. They can also go to your website, which is I go to it all the time. I'm blanking out. Help me out.
Yep, just pineconemacro.com.
There we go. That's what I thought. I didn't want to screw it up. But at pineconemacro.com, again, you're one of the only guys that we actually pay for research from. So if you guys are macro nerds, he's got some great retail products that are not expensive, extremely reasonable. And you are surprisingly predictable, man. You really stick to your schedule and getting those reports out. And I always look forward to giving them a read. Great insight. So I can't recommend it more. So thanks for coming on again. And hopefully we can get you on again soon.
Sounds good. Pleasure.
All right. So tell that little girl of yours and that wife we said hello, and we'll talk to you in the near future. Take care of yourself, pal.
Do the same. Take care.
All right. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We got to wrap it up, but we will, as always, we will be back next week. And I believe we will have the venerable Luke Groman with us to have that currency discussion that we've been wanting to have for a while. So anyway, I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH and 97.3 Cairo FM.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.